Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Not exactly the best laid plans. A former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine tells us it is not clear whether President Trump fully supports the peace proposal leaked to reporters. But as it stands, it appears to require far too many concessions from Kyiv.
And a real hornet's nest. Charlotte Hornets rookie Con Knepel recently brought his whole team home for dinner without having given his parents a head count in advance. But they really rose to the occasion. And in the end, their homemade chicken fajitas were a slam dunk.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Thursday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8 p.m., offering guests martinis and menu items such as chicken Kiev, a Reuben, or fettuccine Alfredo. The dinner menu and additional information are available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Minnesota Mixtape is our deep dive into the local music scene, Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at 3 p.m. with host Malachi Coons. Join him this week to hear new music from the folk duo, The Lowest Pair, indie songwriter Runo Plum, and some early Bob Dylan from the latest bootleg series. And we receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is Charles Bradley with Lonely As You Are.
You think you've been lonely, but loneliness is mine. As lonely as you are, it ain't bad as mine. You think you've been suffering, but suffering is mine. As lonely as you are, it ain't bad as mine. So lonely. Lonely as hell. Been coming to me, trying to make me turn myself loose. But I tell you, God, you're my heart and soul. No one can change me if it called for me to die. But loneliness is mine. As lonely as you are, it ain't bad as mine. You think you've been suffering, but suffering is mine. As lonely as you are, it ain't bad as mine. Don't know me, loneliness, but I know you well. Mama, wherever you at in heaven, please hold a space for me. I'm walking this planet, Mama, like you taught me to do. I'm walking, trying to find you, Mama. One day, when God says, well done, please be at the gate waiting for me with your mama, grandma, Rowena Green, J.W. Welch, and so many more.
And that's Charles Bradley with the song Lonely As You Are.
Oh, baby. Oh. I love you.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
a piece of their minds, Ukrainian officials are pushing back on a purported peace plan that would see them give major concessions to Russia. A former American ambassador to Ukraine tells us Kyiv won't accept any deal that looks like surrender.
An emerging emergency. A paramedic in Saskatoon tells us a toxic drug supply caused more than 100 overdoses in just 7 days. And that crisis has also taken a toll on first responders.
Shaking up the status quo, an Indigenous woman whose mother lost her status for marrying a non-Indigenous man celebrates a change meant to ensure that status passes through generations regardless of who you marry.
The pecking order. An Oxford University biologist traces the history of the kiss and finds that the ancestors of humans and other large apes were locking lips at least 16 million years ago.
Swishful thinking when an NBA rookie's parents suggested he invite some friends over for dinner. They were not expecting the entire roster of the Charlotte Hornets to turn up.
And the biter end. Mm-hmm. We hate a mosquito's proboscis when it's sucking our blood, but we love a mosquito's proboscis when scientists take it off the mosquito and use it as a nozzle in a 3D printer. As it happens, the Thursday edition, radio that presents a good nose, bad nose scenario. The Trump administration has a plan for peace in Ukraine, but it was drafted without the input of a key player, Ukraine. As reports emerged of a proposal to end the war, so did concerns that it's the product of negotiations between the U.S. and Russia only, and apparently demands significant concessions from Kyiv. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he plans to negotiate the details of the plan with President Trump. John Herbst previously served as the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. He's now the senior director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. We reached him in Washington.
John Herbst, so little is known about this proposal. What have you seen? What do you know about what's in it?
My knowledge is incomplete. And the details that have been put out by anonymous voices suggest this looks a great deal like the Russian proposals that were rejected in the spring and around the time of the August meeting between Witkoff and Putin, and then, of course, the Alaska summit. And it's worth remembering that just, a month or two ago, less than two months ago, Trump seemed like he was going to see Putin in Budapest, but then when Rubio spoke with Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, he was told there was nothing new in the Russian proposal. And it's from what we know of this proposal, there's nothing new there either. And conceivably, of course, there could be something new, but we don't have those details yet.
Yeah. On Ukraine's reaction at this stage, the chair of Ukraine's Foreign Policy Committee, Oleksandr Mrejko, spoke to CNN. Here's a bit of what he said.
To me, it looks really suspicious and ludicrous, because to me, it looks like a summary of the previous Russian ludicrous and absolutely unacceptable for Ukraine demands. This plan seems to be aiming at surrender of Ukraine, and for us, it's totally unacceptable. And I do hope that it's not serious.
So given what we heard there, but also recognizing that Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said he intends to negotiate this with the U.S., is there really a path forward here?
I don't think that you're going to see a serious negotiation to achieve Trump's goal of a stable peace, which results in a secure Ukraine at this point in time. Putin still thinks that he can conquer a good bit more of Ukrainian territory. And that was reflected in the proposals we saw in the spring and summer, which, again, have a lot of the details of this proposal, right? Ukraine would voluntarily hand over parts of Western Donbass that Russia has been unable to conquer in something like 38 or 40 months of war, which in itself is ridiculous. And the details that have emerged, and again, we don't know if these details are accurate, that Ukraine would have a limited armed force, right? They'd have to cut down their army. They would have to, they'd be prevented from or not given permission for holding certain advanced weapons. These are kind of, these sound like surrender terms, like the previous things that the Trump White House did not accept. That's why, again, all the lack of transparency about the details, the lack of clarity where does this proposal actually come from, raise significant questions, which is why, of course, this war is very important. Making sure Putin does not win this war is very important for the United States and absolutely critical for Ukraine. And so it's unclear if this is serious.
Strategically speaking, rolling out vague details like this in a very high-profile way, I mean, is it just an attempt to see what sticks? Maybe they'll go for it? Or what's at play there behind the scenes, do you think?
There's no question that this type of rolling out of information is in the Kremlin's interest. And, you know, we saw some of these details appearing very early on Russian Telegram channels before it was hitting even the Western press, which suggests a lot of the rollout is coming from the Russian side. I would imagine that the reason for the lack of clarity is the recognition that these are Russian surrender terms.
We've spoken to analysts and experts, you know, since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and as the years have gone on, some have said, you know, as it's not ideal, it's not what Ukrainians want, but there's going to be, in their view, a need for them to concede something, potentially land. What kind of scenario do you see Ukraine accepting?
Well, look, I believe that Trump came into office with a concept that could lead to his objective of a durable peace. And a durable peace would not be wonderful for Ukraine, but it would be at least substantial improvement of the current circumstances. And why I say it would not be a just peace is because it's based upon the notion of control of Ukrainian land, at least on a de facto basis, would be based upon the current line of control, right? So Russian forces occupy 20%+ of Ukraine. They would continue to occupy that as part of this durable peace. And Zelensky has accepted 5-6 specific Trump proposals to end the shooting. Russia has accepted none. And all those proposals involve Russian control over most, if not all, of the land that it currently occupies. That is painful for Ukraine, mm-hmm. but one that could serve its interest to survive as a secure country. And Zelensky's, again, and I think the Ukrainian public, have demonstrated a willingness to entertain this. I don't think that's the issue. The issue is Putin doesn't want that. He wants effective political control of Ukraine. And, of course, Trump can't go for that because that would make him look foolish.
The European Union's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, said that governments cannot agree to a deal that benefits, quote, the one who is doing the killing, unquote. What would end this, in your view?
Putin believes that just as he outweighed Biden, outweighed Merkel, outweighed Boris Johnson, he can outweigh President Trump. And President Trump has acknowledged publicly on numerous occasions that maybe Putin is playing him. But Trump considers himself, and I understand this, which makes sense, he considers himself a very strong leader who does not get played in ways that hurt the United States. So that's why I don't think that The plan we are hearing about in an incomplete way and probably a highly biased way reflects a position Trump will ultimately support. And if he wants to be the Nobel Prize winner for achieving a durable peace to Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine, the terms we're hearing about cannot be the basis for settlement.
John Herbst, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
John Herbst previously served as the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. He's in Washington. It's an amendment to a bill that was already amending an act, which sounds processy and incremental. But for people who've lived under the thumb of the Indian Act, it's a big deal, and it's been a long time coming. Bill S-2 is intended to restore status to a small group of people who gave it up for a variety of reasons, including to keep their children out of residential schools, to vote in federal and provincial elections, or to graduate university. But many people argue that the bill did not go far enough, particularly around something called the second generation cutoff. And this week, a Senate committee passed sweeping amendments to Bill S-2, putting it one step closer to becoming law. Dawn Lavelle Harvard was there when it passed. She's the former president of the Native Women's Association of Canada. Half a century ago, her mother, Jeanette Corbier Lavelle, took the federal government to court after losing her own status for marrying a non-Indigenous man. We reached Dawn Lavelle Harvard near Peterborough, Ontario.
Dawn, I know your mother couldn't be there. So what were you doing as all of this was unfolding?
Well, the first thing, I was texting her because, you know, we're trying to be in there silent as this was going through. And then when I sent her the note saying, oh, my God, you'll never believe this actually went through. And she actually sent a note back saying, she said, maybe it's good I'm not there, because she said, I'm sitting here in bed just ugly crying and I'm sobbing. And she said, you know, so she, this is a really big deal. And she's always said that, you know, she wants to see this fixed before she goes on into the spirit world, because, you know, she's in her 80s now and she has spent over 50 years fighting for this. So, you know, I was having trouble holding myself together when she said that.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, how did you keep it together? And how did you continue after that?
Oh, I didn't. After she said that, I couldn't hold it together. I was crying too, and half of the room was crying, because This is literally one choice to make. Like, it was really clear. You can either say yes to the amendments and say yes to the one-parent rule, say yes to ending that second generation cutoff, or you're saying yes to the extinction of our people. And it really is as simple as that. There is so much confusing the issue, but that's really what it boils down to at the end of the day. And this yes vote, even though there's many hurdles that still have to come with, you know, getting through multiple readings, mm-hmm. and going through the House of Commons and the potential that they're going to send it back, but this is the first time that we have had this amendment, you know, solidly. It's passed, it's going through, that anybody's had the courage to address this rather than just putting it off to future governments.
And just to let our listeners know, so this rule, the second generation cutoff, was first introduced in 1985. Just briefly, let our listeners know what that has meant for families such as yours.
Yeah, the rule was introduced in 1985 when they made the amendments that allowed, because of the Sandra Lovelace case and the Canadian government reinstating those women who had lost their status and their children. So at that time, when they amended the Indian Act to allow the women to come back, they also inserted this clause, which is the second generation cutoff, which essentially said, fine, those women can come back, but the whole thing ends with that second generation, which would have been, you know, the children. And all these conversations now, thinking that this is opening this up to all kinds of strangers coming, people, you know, seven generations back. The second generation cutoff only applies to those born after 1985. My two daughters, if they had children, their children would be cut off. They would not be allowed to be members of our community. They would not have status. And so it's really about our children and grandchildren moving forward.
And so that sounds like that is your answer to those who are expressing concern, saying that there's going to be, you know, this flood of people coming in with claims of Indigenous heritage.
Well, and the interesting part is there's also First Nations have the right, individual bands have the right to develop their own band membership code, which means that they can develop rules that either accept or not accept those after the second generation cutoff. They have the right to do that. There's a process. But also, when we looked at the numbers, it really amounts to maybe a dozen, you know, new band members, new babies that are being born, new members coming in, a dozen per community over the next 40 years or what have you. So this is not going to be some huge flood of people overwhelming our communities, but what it does mean is that for each of those precious lives, those children being born, you know, there's a grandmother in my community right now who every time we have this conversation, she says, well, my daughter, you know, why is it my grandchildren can't have status? And I have to explain to her every time, it's because your daughter was born after 1985. And so, you know, there's children who should be going to nursery school, who should be accessing a language, who should be getting support, our children and grandchildren. And right now they're not, because of this second generation cutoff. Those precious children are being denied their rights.
The bill was designed to deal with a very narrow legal issue. At the center of it, a few thousand people and their descendants who want to have their status reinstated because they had to give it up. They lost it if they wanted to be able to vote or graduate from university. So what do you say to those, including Indigenous Services Minister Mandy Galmasti, who say this bill needs to pass quickly to meet the legal deadlines for that case and that the second generation question should be dealt with later?
We've heard that minister after minister after minister. Every time they have made an amendment, they have said, we'll deal with that later. And they kick it down the line to future generations until we reach literally this point where we are here now, where we have babies being born. We have children who have no rights or support in our communities because each minister, each Senate has pushed it down the line and not had the courage to address it. So we have an opportunity to do this right thing, do the right thing right now, and say that we are not okay with the extinction of First Nations peoples.
You mentioned the one-parent rule. What will that amendment mean for people? What will it do?
It means that if there is a status Indian and they have a child, that child will have status. Plain and simple. That if you are a baby born to a status Indian parent, you will have status. You will have the right to be a member of our communities. And it's something that if you're a Canadian citizen and you have a child, your child has the right to be a Canadian citizen. And nobody seems to be outraged by that. Nobody talks about the impact on Canadian society. Then if that child marries somebody who's, let's say, American, nobody has a problem. It's a fundamental right that Canadian citizens have. And what I've always thought interesting is when people say, well, being a status Indian comes with, you know, certain rights. Well, so does being a Canadian citizen. People brave boats going over oceans to try to come here for the special rights of being a Canadian citizen. And we have no problem with a one-parent rule in those contexts. And yet when it comes to First Nations people, they often get up in arms because it's about that fundamental assumption that has been throughout Canadian history that First Nations people were going to disappear eventually, that eventually this would not be a problem. And we have come to a place in our history, if we're talking about reconciliation, if people want to say they're committed to reconciliation, this is the number one action right here, going to a one-parent rule, which, by the way, was fine before 1985, if it was your one parent was a man, that this is the one fundamental action that will ensure the continued existence of our people, and not doing it will ensure the eventual eradication of our people. It's that simple.
Dawn, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Dawn Lavelle Harvard is the former president of the Native Women's Association of Canada. We reached her near Peterborough, Ontario. Con Knuppel doesn't get to spend that much time with his family anymore. He's an NBA player now. The 20-year-old travels all over the country with the Charlotte Hornets. But last week, he was back in his hometown of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, so the Hornets could play the Milwaukee Bucks. And to his mother, Sherry Nordgaard Knuppel, that seemed like the perfect opportunity for him to come home for a family dinner. So she texted him, and he agreed to come. But the meal didn't quite turn out as she'd planned. We reached Sherry Nordgaard Knuppel in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Sherry, when you casually say to your son, invite whoever you want to dinner, I mean, what was your definition of whoever?
Well, my husband suggested Con invite the team over for dinner. I was thinking, you know, maybe the four rookies, you know, and a couple of the other guys that he's hung out with outside of practice and that sort of thing.
That's a lot of mouths to feed anyway. We're talking about NBA players, young men. They're going to be hungry when they show up for home cooking. When did you realize that it was going to be more than that four or five?
About midday on Thursday, the Hornets media director texted me and said, the team bus will be pulling in at 6:30 p.m. We just kind of thought, hey, we have five sons and they have friends over all the time. I'm used to just adding a plate to the island, you know, and, you know, just making sure we have enough food to feed everybody.
Five boys. Lord help you, Sherry. You have your hands full anyway. So what, I mean, how do you make a menu for that many people in that time span?
Well, we had purchased 15 pounds of chicken fajita fixings. Right. And as soon as I found out the whole team bus was coming, I sent my husband out to the store to buy 10 more pounds. I knew that I would be, you know, good to go. I could make it all happen if I was cooking by 1 p.m. and they were all going to get there at 6:30. So we made it work.
So you had about 6 hours to do everything?
Yes. Oh, well, I mean, earlier in the day, I was making the house perfect. You know, once we found out the videographers were coming, you know, my husband before that said, they're guys, they don't care.
Yeah, I was going to say the players don't care.
Boys. They're men, they don't care what the house looks like. But then we found out the videographers were coming. We're like, oh, we got to make every square inch perfect. So yes, running around with our heads cut off, you know, cleaning the house. My husband was doing the yard work, you know, getting all the leaves up and making everything presentable.
And so where does everybody sit? This is not one extra plate or another. You pull up a chair.
It was about midday also where I freaked out a little bit because we have an island that sits 14. But I started to think, oh, no, a big 7-footer is not going to be able to sit right next to a 6'7", you know, guy. So I'm like, we're probably going to be able to fit 7 around the island, truthfully. So we, you know, we had the island set up and then I brought up a big 6-foot card table. I quickly ran out to Target and grabbed some nice tablecloth to cover the card table. And it ended up being really, really nice. They just made themselves at home.
Oh, well, because you made them feel at home right away.
Oh,
that's you. I guess the rest of the family has helped too, but for sure you. So it was fajitas. What else was on the menu?
Fajitas, rice and beans. Yeah. Corn, like a spicy corn with Rotel in it. And we had churros. I did have an ice cream cake that was a Hornets ice cream cake, but my boys had eaten it. Yeah, so I was prepared for that. So I said, go get more churros because we were going to have the ice cream cake too.
I like these kids. They know. Like, we're not, I don't care if it's the NBA. We're going to eat this ice cream cake. Yeah. How old are they?
My boys are 14, 15, 16, and 18.
Oh, my God. And their brother's in the NBA, and their mom is you. So they must be just... I mean, are they over it, or are they excited? I mean, it's not just their brother. The whole team is in their house.
Oh, yeah. They were so jazzed. They were so excited. They were trying to play it cool, but as soon as the team left, they said, Mom, send me the pictures you got, because you know they were putting them to the Snapchat right away.
Yeah, no doubt about that. That's going to take them a while. Like, that's going to take them far throughout their high school years, for sure. Well, did these players, I mean, do they bring hostess gifts?
Let me tell you, their presence was enough because I was so thankful for them caring enough about Con too. To show up at his house and get to know him a little bit more, you know, see where he grew up. So their presence alone meant the world to us.
That's beautiful. Were you able to even enjoy your son when you were so busy?
Oh, he's a little quieter in the group of the whole team. Sure. And he knew I was just plane hostess, but the team bus left and he stayed with us for a couple of hours after. So that was nice. And we asked him, are you going to stay overnight? Are you going to, you know, sleep in your own bed for once instead of a hotel? And he said, no, I'm not changing my routine. So he hung out for a couple hours and went back to the hotel.
Smart. And he scored 32 points against the Bucks in the game. Gosh. I know the team didn't win, but do you think your home cooking helped fuel his his success?
I think any time you have time with, you know, those you love, just feeling all the support, I think it was a mix of all of that.
Oh, that's so lovely, Sherry. But you've got American Thanksgiving is coming up. I mean, are you done? Are you going to gear up for that too?
The thing I have to do is make 10 pounds of potatoes, mashed potatoes, goodness, and about 13 sweet potatoes. So that's really easy. I do that in the morning before our meal.
Just a breeze. That's great, Sherry. I'm so glad we could speak. This was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Sherry Nordgaard-Knepel had her son, Conn Knepel, and unexpectedly his NBA teammates over for dinner. She's in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Think of your worst enemy. You don't have to say their name, especially, you know, if they're sitting right there. Just think about someone you absolutely cannot stand. Now, let me ask you this. This enemy, would you remove their nose and use it as a nozzle in, let's say, your frozen yogurt machine? If it worked, great. I'm hearing a lot of no's, and I think that's on me for introducing the hypothetical frozen yogurt. That was a mistake. Look, some thought experiments are fascinating questions of morality, and some just make you think of frozen yogurt being extruded through a disembodied human nose. It's worse every time I think about it. Look, I'll get to the point. Scientists at McGill are removing proboscises from mosquitoes and using them as nozzles in a 3D printer. What happened was they were trying to print very, very fine details, but the existing nozzles weren't fine enough and they were expensive. So they asked a graduate student to look for an option that was A, cheap, and B, durable, which led them to look at durable nozzles that might exist in nature, which led them to the female Egyptian mosquito and its very, very fine proboscis. And it worked. They can produce 6 nozzles per hour by removing proboscises from these whiny jerks and customizing them, which might feel a little ghoulish, especially when you consider that they call this process necroprinting. But the proboscises work great, and they're sturdy, and they're inexpensive, so no one is paying through the nose. Oh, God, no. I'm thinking about the frozen yogurt again. Quick, play Mosquito by Jail. Jail with Mosquito.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, a BC neurologist wins a big prize for his work on Parkinson's disease, which he says is all about how different brains respond to dopamine.
and lip service. After a whole lot of research, our guest says she's been able to confirm that our early ancestors first began kissing at least 16 million years ago. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Cooksell.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. Support for KAXE comes from Woodworks Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com. Programming on KXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funding is available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants. Now back to As It Happens.
104 overdoses in just 7 days, two of them fatal. That's what the fire department in Saskatoon had to handle last week. That terrifying spike led the Saskatchewan Ministry of Health to issue a warning to drug users there and in Regina. People who thought they'd scored meth ended up with what turned out to be opioids like fentanyl and other unidentified dangerous substances. Jennifer Flair is a paramedic for a drop-in center operated by the nonprofit Prairie Harm Reduction. We reached her in Saskatoon.
Jennifer, to read or hear those numbers and learn about the reality, that's one thing. But for you, working in Saskatoon on the front lines of this as this all unfolded, what was that like?
It is a stressful situation. We're having to deal, sometimes with multiple overdoses at once and trying to manage that. At Prairie Harm Reduction, we just have two paramedics here. So we do the best we can with just the two of us and the additional hands we have that have basic first aid CPR training to help us. But without all of our needed supplies, it is hard sometimes to get the job done efficiently.
The headlines and the reporting characterize this as something very, very different, particularly tough to handle, the province is saying this time. Has that been your experience?
Yeah. So us alone, we've experienced 9 overdoses at our building that we've responded to since the beginning of November. All of these have been taking multiple doses of Narcan, sometimes up to 8 milligrams of Narcan to have the patient regain consciousness. So it is definitely taking a lot more Narcan. We've been doing some drug testing as well on site here, and we're starting to see benzodiazepines being mixed in with the fentanyl supplies a little bit more than the past couple of months.
And
benzodiazepines, they're a suppressant. So they'll drop respiratory drive. They can drop level of consciousness. And they are not compatible with Narcan, so Narcan will not work on them. And we just started seeing metatomidine in some of the fentanyl tests as well, which we haven't seen since I've started working with Prairie Harm Reduction. And that's a veterinary tranquilizer.
Oh my goodness. How is this happening? Why do you think this is happening, that they're being mixed in this way?
It's really hard to say. I'm not the person that's doing it, so I can't really specify why these things are being mixed in. They do have very similar effects as fentanyl does, and it takes less of it to get those effects. So that could be one thing where they're able to put, less fentanyl in and some of this other stuff to kind of fill it up and make it seem like there's more fentanyl.
People who are there to help other people, I mean, it must be terrifying when this is happening in front of you. And the Narcan that's supposed to work with one dose is taking two or three or more.
Yeah, so, you know, it's definitely tough and stressful, especially with us at Pray Harm, where we work day to day with, you know, everybody that uses our site, whether it's the drop-in or the safe consumption site that we have here. So we do build, you know, relationships with people. We get to know them and we get to know their stories. And, you know, those are the people that we do see sometimes experiencing these overdoses. Mm-hmm. So it does hit a little bit harder when you do have that, you know, that personal connection to somebody.
And what are they telling you? You know, they're hearing what's happening, or they're seeing what's happening if they haven't experienced it themselves, the folks you work with. What are they telling you? Are they scared?
Yeah, so we haven't, you know, had the words "I'm scared" come out of anybody's mm-hmm. mouth yet. But what I can tell you is, so we typically average about 20 drug tests per month. So far in November, we're at about 40 to 45. To make sure it's safe, or, you know, they're experiencing an overdose or someone experienced an overdose and they want to know, like, you know, what is in this? Why did this happen when this person hasn't overdosed before? Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're coming to us with that to try and, you know, see what's in their substances, see if it is safe for them. So
beyond not using and doing that testing, as you've described, as some are approaching you for, what do you tell people about how they can protect themselves given what's unfolding?
Yeah, so never use alone, especially with, you know, the supply that's out right now that's so harmful. Always have somebody with you. You know, it's the buddy system. And then always have Narcan with you. And Narcan is, it's going to work on the fentanyls to regain that respiratory drive and regain consciousness. And then just following up with 911 if that doesn't work.
Did you work with or know either of the two people who've died?
I can't comment on that.
Okay.
It's, yeah,
understood.
Private information.
Understood. The provincial alert is set to stay in effect for another week now. Have things shifted since that alert has come into effect?
We have seen a little bit of a slowdown in regards to the overdoses on our end in the area around our building here that we've been responding to, which is always a positive. So I don't know if that's been a shift in the drug supply or if it's, you know, people are just tapering down mm-hmm. what's being used. But there has definitely been less this week than the past couple of weeks.
So some relief. It appears,
yeah,
at least for now. You know, you seem to be, I've only just met you and I'm only hearing your voice, but how do you take care of yourself and your small team when,
yes,
you know, obviously you're focused on helping other people, that's why you're there, but this is difficult for everyone, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, first and foremost, in that moment, we focus on the person in front of us. We make sure they're okay. And luckily enough for us, we haven't had any fatalities during working hours for us that we've had to work through right now. But, you know, we always check in with each other, make sure everybody's doing okay. There is a great overdose outreach support that we provide to the people that have overdosed or have friends that are overdosing. And they will help people get in touch with different support systems and kind of work through those steps.
Taking care of each other
mm-hmm.
as best you can.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Jennifer, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Of course.
Jennifer Flair is a paramedic with the organization Prairie Harm Reduction. We reached her in Saskatoon. It's been 4 months since Ghanaian refugee Belinda Sarkodie was shot and killed while waiting for a bus in Hamilton, Ontario. She was only 26, and she'd been trying to build a life in Canada. Yesterday, police announced the arrest of a 17-year-old who's been charged with second-degree murder. Ms. Sarkodie left Ghana in 2024, seeking refuge in Canada as a member of the 2S LGBTQ plus community. Her friend Evelyn Adu and her girlfriend, Grace Nasiru, spoke to CBC reporter Samantha Beattie.
I mean, it's a mixed feeling. I don't know if I'm excited that he turned himself in. I mean, it took over 4 months. I don't know who was hiding this boy. He's a 17-year-old young man. Whoever was hiding him for over 4 months, shame on them. It took Belinda dying. It took a vigil. It took her funeral. It took burying her, all of that. And nobody thought of coming out. And then suddenly they think they showed up. Well, I hope that justice will be served. You know, they're going to quote unquote say he's 17, is a kid. I hope that does not fly in court. It didn't happen soon enough, so I don't know how I feel.
He turned himself in. I was happy and at the same time sad because, you know, she was innocent and just taking someone's life just like that and for no reason, it's still kind of a shock to me. And I don't know where these, you know, these teenagers and all these people get the guns from and all that. I'm glad that he has been able to turn himself in. So I'm just hoping that justice will be served, yeah.
How are you coping with everything?
You know, it's not been easy for the family, especially with the mom. It's you know, to lose a child, it's something that it shouldn't happen to anyone. We console ourselves because there's nothing we can do about it. She can't come back. So the only thing we have to do is to console ourselves and we hope justice will be served. At least that alone will kind of be a compensation, yeah.
When they had the news today, I was hoping that the police had allowed at least Richard, the brother, or even the sister who is still here, Linda, to be there, standing on stage to actually express how they feel and how they want the justice system to handle this. Because all we saw is police saying somebody turned themselves in. And I would have wished that when the police made an announcement, that Belinda's family would have actually been standing right next to them, also sharing their pain and what they're still going through. Somebody raising their child to be in their 20s, they travel from a place where they don't feel, I guess, safe enough. And then they come to a place to seek refuge. And somebody who's playing with guns, like Grace is rightfully saying, where do they get these guns from?
That was Grace Nasiru and Evelyn Adu speaking to CBC reporter Samantha Beattie about Belinda Sarkodi, who was shot and killed in Hamilton, Ontario in July. A new study has shed a light on the evolution of, quote, non-agonistic interaction involving directed, intraspecific oral-oral contact with some movement of the lips slash mouth parts and no food transfer, unquote. Or, to put it less erotically, kissing. Matilda Brindle is an Oxford University evolutionary biologist and the lead author of this paper, published this week in the journal Evolution and Human Behavior. We reached her in London.
Matilda, did you feel a bit ridiculous trying to come up with that definition for kissing, all of those words?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the most romantic definition ever, is it? I mean, it's an interesting one, right? Like, humans kissing, we kind of know what that looks like. And intuitively, it feels like a silly thing to try and define because it's so obvious. But actually, we wanted to pull out these kind of large evolutionary reasons for kissing, or the evolutionary history of kissing. And for that, we needed a definition that worked across different animals. And those animals might not even have lips. So, I mean, we, you know, humans, we know we protrude our lips. There's a slight suction motion with kissing. That's not going to work for a polar bear or an ant, for example. So
kissing
we had
ants.
To kind of, yeah, I know, kissing ants. And actually, ants do seem to kiss. There's evidence that they do based on our definition. So it had to be kind of broad enough that it included lots of animals. But actually, we didn't want to include all behaviours that potentially look like kissing. So things like pre-mastication, which is where food is pre-chewed, often by mothers, and then that will be fed orally. So that looks like kissing, but it's clearly not kissing. Right. So we had to kind of find this middle ground, which is why in our definition we've got some quite broad things, like lips or mouth parts, and then we've got some narrow things, like there must not be any food transfer, or it can't be an aggressive interaction.
And ultimately, there's two big takeaways from your research. Tell our listeners what they are, what you found.
So we found that kissing stretches back to at least 21.5 million years ago in the ancestor of all of the large apes. So that's humans and our closest living relatives, which are chimpanzees and bonobos and gorillas and orangutans. So the ancestor of that entire group kissed, and they lived around 21.5 million years ago. But as well as reconstructing the kind of the ancient history, the evolutionary history of kissing, we wanted to look at whether Neanderthals kiss. Now, Neanderthals aren't our ancestor. They are another kind of branch on the tree of life. And so what we did was reconstruct this tip that was Neanderthals, and we found that they probably kissed too. And that was particularly interesting to us. We were really interested in exploring Neanderthals more because we know that most humans of non-African descent actually have a small amount of Neanderthal DNA, which means that at some point humans and Neanderthals were interbreeding. The other thing we know is that after the two species split, so after humans and Neanderthals separated into different species, they shared an oral microbe for at least a couple of 100,000 years. Now, what that means is that they were swapping saliva. And that could have been kind of over a friendly campfire. They were sharing food and kind of, you know, there wasn't loads of oral hygiene and they shared saliva that way. But given the fact that they were interbreeding, and then when you add to that our finding that, you know, humans kiss and Neanderthals kissed, it kind of makes sense that they were maybe kissing each other. And I think that adds just a much more romantic spin on human-Neanderthal relationships.
But the evidence itself, I mean, it's limited, right? There's not drawings on walls. What are you drawing
from?
No
drawings.
Right? Yeah.
No fossils. We ran basically evolutionary simulations in what's known as a phylogenetic analysis. And in order to do that, you need two bits of information. You need to know the distribution of your trait of interest, so in this case, kissing, across living species. So we collected data on which primates kissing has been observed in. And then you also need to know the kind of evolutionary relationships between the species you're looking at. So we took something called a phylogenetic tree, which is basically just a big family tree, but with species instead of family members. And that just maps out the genetic relatedness between the different species of primate. And with that information, you can track back through evolutionary history. You can kind of track through that tree and work out which ancestors were kissing or not. So if you think about it this way, we know that humans and our two closest living relatives, bonobos and chimpanzees, all kiss. So it makes sense that their ancestor kissed too. And you can kind of iterate that backwards through the tree. And it's an evolutionary simulation, essentially. So it's all computational, but that can map the evolutionary history of whatever trait you're interested in.
What was the moment you decided that this needed to be studied?
I have a long-standing interest in the evolution of behaviors that might not at first glance look like they have an evolutionary function. So, for example, my PhD research was actually on the evolution of masturbation across the primates, which, again, lots of people think, okay, well, why? It doesn't necessarily need to have evolved. It's just a byproduct. And kissing is the same. People don't think it necessarily has an evolutionary function. You might assume it's just a sort of a cultural innovation. And I wanted to basically test that hypothesis and say, actually, has it got an evolutionary signal? I think it's really fascinating to look at these, particularly sexual behaviors, non-reproductive sexual behaviors, and try and work out if they are just sort of, I guess, like nice trinkets of behavior that are related to sex, or if they actually have a function themselves. And the things I've looked at so far, like masturbation, do have their own evolutionary functions. And kissing was one of these things that was just so fascinating.
You write in the study, quote, kissing poses an evolutionary problem since it does not appear to aid survival or reproduction in an obvious way, while the potential costs of disease transfer are high, unquote. I mean, if you're doing it right, it feels great. And I'd say there's a good argument that you're not going to get to the reproduction part if you're not starting with kissing, right?
Exactly. And that's a really good point. And it's one of the hypotheses that have been put out there is that kissing, if it does have a function, or at least sexual kissing, could be there basically to pre-arouse individuals before they have sex. And that can, A, be more likely to lead to sex itself, which is quite important for reproducing. And B, if you are aroused before sex, then it's quite possible that you're more likely to be fertilized during that sex.
Matilda, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Thank you so much. Good to meet you.
That's Oxford University evolutionary biologist Matilda Brindle in London. According to Parkinson's Canada, more than 110,000 people in this country are living with the complex brain disease. Jason Chan and his colleagues are working to understand as much as they can about it, with the hope of providing better care and quality of life to patients. Now, Dr. Chan, who's a Surrey Memorial Hospital neurologist, has been recognized for that work. He's received a 2025 Michael Smith Health Research BC Health Professional Investigator Award. It comes with $90,000 per year for 5 years, which he says will be used to expand the team working on this research. Dr. Jason Chan talked to the CBC yesterday.
Parkinson's disease is a disease that is neurodegenerative, meaning that brain cells are lost over time. And in Parkinson's, the specific brain cells that are affected are the ones that make a chemical called dopamine. In the public sphere, dopamine is probably best known as the happy chemical. But with Parkinson's disease, we know that that is a much more complex picture. And so when the brain loses these dopamine-producing cells, people experience slowness of movement, stiffness, tremor, among other movement-related symptoms. And as the brain networks change, patients often experience non-movement symptoms as well, affecting cognition, mood, anxiety, blood pressure, and a whole bunch of other things.
Okay, so your research has gained this recognition. Well, what can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so the research program that we're trying to build up in Surrey, along with Simon Fraser University and within Fraser Health, is to look at how patients' brains respond to dopamine medication over time as medication takes effect, and then perhaps even wears off. And the reason why we're looking at this is because people with Parkinson's are quite variable, meaning that no one person, or no two people with the disease are alike. Each patient or each person with Parkinson's will experience the disease very differently in terms of what symptoms they have, in terms of how the disease changes, in terms of how the medications work for them, as well as what side effects they get. And so the idea of our research is to use advanced brain imaging in the form of magnetoencephalography, or MEG, and magnetic resonance imaging in MRI, to track these changes of brain activity basically over the course of a patient's dopamine dose taking its effect.
Okay, how long a period is that? How long does a dopamine dose last?
That's a great question. And so that's part of the variability. So most people with Parkinson's will experience the onset of effect within 15 to 30 minutes, some up to an hour. The maximum effect typically takes place somewhere around 2 hours, and the duration effect is quite variable, right? So many people early on in their disease can have a duration of effect, you know, upwards of 8+ hours, but it's quite common over a disease course as someone gets older with Parkinson's for that time frame to shorten.
That's Surrey, BC neurologist Jason Chan talking to Gloria Makarenko, host of On the Coast.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
Community Radio at 91.7.